Have you heard the one about the guy who goes sailing on the weekend with his dog? And a little storm comes up, and they're swept away to sea, and they end up fortuitously on a desert island, which has some rather nice features, including fruit trees and even a flock of wild sheep. And so the guy sets up house there, and after he's been there a while, the sheep start to look good to him. In fact, one sheep in particular. One night, after he's been there for it seems like a long time, been without any real companionship, he tiptoes over to the herd and starts to do the wrong thing with one of these sheep. But his dog is with him, and his dog looks at this tableau, and it doesn't look natural to the dog, so the dog starts barking. Kind of puts the guy off his mood for a while, but after a few more weeks, one morning he wakes up and he's got this particular sheep on his mind, and he looks over and he sees his dog is asleep. So he tiptoes out to the herd again, and he starts to do an unnatural act with this particular sheep, but the dog has missed him and follows him out there and barks and puts him off his mood. So he gives up again, but that night a big storm comes up, and in the morning he's taking a walk around the island to survey the damage, and they come to the beach, and there's a shipwreck and a very beautiful woman lying in the sand, barely alive, so he takes her back to his little shack and nurses her back to health. And after she's healthy, she's grateful. And one morning she looks at him and says, I really appreciate everything you've done for me. Is there anything that, I could do for you, anything at all? And he says, well, would you mind watching my dog for about 15 minutes?
I would be reading for the older brother of the central character, played by Louis Stadlin. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Well, he's a minor New York actor, but he also happens to be one of my arch enemies. He once called me a putz and a moron. He was in the production that I told you I understudied Nathan Lane, called Mislansky Zelinsky, and I knew there was a good chance I would have to go on in this massive role, this play by John Robin Bates, if Nathan Lane decided to go and do this pilot he had been offered out in California. So I had like 6 weeks to learn the lines, but I just couldn't get too enthused about learning the lines until I knew for sure that he was going to be going.
How many days in advance did you?
I probably knew about a week in advance that it was definite. So I plugged away for a week, and I knew it pretty well. But I didn't know it really deeply. I mean, I paraphrased certain things. I didn't give accurate cues. And so when I went on the first few performances, I was pretty sloppy, I was a little nervous. I was a little overwhelmed because people were being told that Nathan Lane wasn't performing that night.
They were walking out.
Some of them walked out. Some of them walked out after intermission when they saw how bad I was. And I could feel that the other people in the cast were really pretty disgusted with me for not being more prepared. So there was this mounting tension. And Louis Stadlin, who played the opposite, the second guy, was Mislansky Zelinsky. He was Zelinsky. And I was Mislansky. He was pretty tense about the whole thing. And I was making mistakes. I'd cut people off sometimes. First two performances were pretty bad. And then I had a huge fight with this very close friend of mine who was in the play. Got drunk one night and really launched into me for being unprepared, just doing it all wrong. And as the days went on, there was a pretty frosty environment there. I felt to a certain extent that they weren't even giving me a chance to ease into the part. And by the end of the week, when I could feel that they just weren't really much liking what I was doing, I had a pretty good performance. I had a really good one. You could just tell that the audience was really responding. And I was getting a lot of the laughs that Nathan Lane nobody left at the intermission. And I came backstage in this intermission, it was on a Sunday, and I think a few other people said, hey, nice work, it's coming along, kind of thing. And I just kind of lost it, and I said, you guys are f***ed up. You could have given me a little encouragement earlier in the week. You don't have to wait till I finally get it right. And that really set them off. They became livid at my lack of appreciation for their support, because they held me totally responsible for essentially having, you know, had a bad week. And they just all attacked me.
What were they saying?
That I was just a lazy, unprepared person that didn't do what he was supposed to do and all that kind of thing.
Unprofessional.
Unprofessional. How dare I complain to them? They're the ones that have been carrying me. And it was just an ugly scene. So we really were screaming at each other in the middle of this intermission.
And did they have the second act come?
Actually, the second act was even better for me, because it was such a strange situation. I felt such hatred for them that I just... I went out there and I had a great second act. And Louis Stadlin, who had just called me a putz and a moron, was just seething with contempt. On stage, you could just feel his contempt and his seething. Every line that he said, he kind of barked at me and shot at me like an arrow, you know. And but I just used it. Because he was so over the top with his anger that I just turned it around. At one point, he started screaming at me. He got right in my face on a line that's really not that angry, you know. He overdid it, but he decided to let out his contempt in the line. And he got right in my face, and it was a line that only said, "I don't want you ever to do this again." And he said, "I don't want you ever to do this again." And I just very slowly turned to the audience, you know, and gave them, like, "I don't know what he's talking about, look." And they howled, you know, because I had turned all his anger back on him. And well, that's the last I saw of him.
And now you have the prospect of playing opposite him in a Neil Simon.
The prospect of going in and auditioning, and then him finding out that they were, if they were interested in me, he might try to keep me out of it or tell them what a bum I was. I mean, it is an ironic situation that I should be auditioning for his older brother in this big Neil Simon play. So this would probably be a good time for a dignified suicide, or at least a retirement from active duty.
What is a dignified suicide?
Harakiri, something like that, kind of a disembowelment.
But that's pretty disgusting, really.
So maybe it should be a little more like Marilyn Monroe, who says, "I just lie there naked, be discovered naked in your bed, having taken a massive dose of sleeping pills."
I think suicide is kind of unseemly. I think about it all the time, but I don't want people to know it's a suicide, so I have another plan, which is that I'm going to rent a small compact and find a location where there's a bridge stanchion or something, that concrete abutment or wall of some kind that I can hit at a very high speed and then drive down the freeway about 100 miles an hour without my seatbelt, and then just go flush into whatever that is. And then people will say that I don't know, lost control of my car. There might be some question about whether it's suicide, but...
Well, I'd love to know if you, if you were planning to do it. It wouldn't need to be no skin off your back, as they say. If I could take out a modest, maybe $1 million insurance policy.
You don't think that people would be a little bit suspicious?
Well, they would wonder, but they wouldn't wonder if I was responsible for your death, I don't think. I think they'd wonder why you would do that macabre thing.
Right after you took out $1 million insurance policy on my life.
Yeah, and they'd probably assume that we were lovers and it was some kind of a tontine. Or maybe it was a game of chicken. Maybe that where we were both going in different directions and we were going to do a double suicide.
You mean you in New York and me in Los Angeles in some bizarre...
Kind of thing with cell phones linked up, but there had to be a money involvement. We both had insurance policies on the other. And the question is, who would actually do it?
Well, that's interesting. You know, if I took $1 million insurance policy on your life, and you had one on mine, we both rented compact cars, you in New York, me in Los Angeles, and then we both drove into bridge abutments.
Right. And I could do on the Long Island Freeway, there's some lovely ones. I've seen them. I've gone speeding by these abutments and say, boy, if you just made a little right turn, man, you're there.
And the high irony of it, that both of us as beneficiaries would be dead. And neither of us would be able to collect on the other's insurance.
Well, that would be the worst-case scenario. But on the other hand, the game of it is that if one person chickened out and the other person died, the living one would be punished to live with the disgrace and humiliation of not having the courage and having been perhaps to some extent responsible for his friend's death.
And the recipient of $1 million.
And the recipient of $1 million, which they probably wind up abusing the money and dying
through some other means.
Well, I don't know. There could be an upside. I mean, a person who gets $1 million might get a new lease on life, feel much more positive,
right,
and feel encouraged by
the other person's death?
And the new sense of security and freedom, and be able to travel wherever you want, or live in better circumstances, or it could be a wonderful thing for the survivor. I have a funny feeling that were we to do that, the two of us
both miss.
I wanted to go to the encyclopedia and look up the anniversary of when the Golden Spike was driven, when the eastern-facing railroad from the West Coast and the western-facing railroad from the East Coast were joined somewhere on the Great Prairie, so you two could begin a western journey for Larry and an eastern journey for you, and meet on a highway somewhere in the midst of this great nation of ours.
You mean in a head-on collision?
In a head-on collision.
One of the preoccupations of human beings over the centuries has been to find in this complicated world of human experience that which is sacred or transcendent or timeless, that takes us beyond the small sense of self and the small world in which we live, and opens us up to something that is vast, universal. And although it takes many forms throughout the world, it is always the same. It is a journey from the mundane world, where we live lost, unconscious in some ways, to discover that which is holy and sacred, and then to return with that or integrate that understanding of the holy and the sacred into our life. And the word holy is the same word as whole, not cut off, not separate from the world, but wise in the midst of all its realms. The first stage in this journey of discovery is this stage of renunciation. It's not a very popular word in Western culture, but another word for it is disenchantment. A moment that says, there must be more. There must be more than just going through the rhythm of one's day, or one's work, or one's family, or one's creative projects. There must be something more than this. And for some, it's a sense of a deep possibility of living with greater compassion on this earth and greater freedom, that we know somehow that's possible. For others, it's looking around and seeing the level of consumerism and desireism in our culture, the kind of ambition that Joseph Campbell spoke of, climbing the ladder only to discover it was against the wrong wall. The level of addiction, of grasping, that drives a kind of modern consumer society, so that we're busy all the time getting and having and being better than and not really paying attention to our heart. And there's a moment of remembering, is this really what I want? And so this renunciation is like a wake-up call inside to say this life, with its beauty and its pain, its pleasure and its suffering, it's really very tentative. It must be that there's some meaning, some possibility of awakening in the midst of it. So somehow, in the heart, in the mind, we sense or hear or know that there must be some other way, something that's possible as humans, beside the common busyness that we know. And the beginning of this is not so much to set out in quest of something, but the opposite, to not do, just to stop, to listen to the stars, to the cosmos, to the forest, to our own hearts, just to begin to listen. What is this? And sometimes it's lonely. It touches that solitude of the heart. But that brings us deeper to what we can discover is true. Don Jose Rios, at 106 years old, the old Huichol shaman, said, "I've practiced my apprenticeship for 84 years. Many times have I gone to the mountains alone. Yes, I've endured much suffering in my life. Yet to hear the voices of the gods, you must do this. For it is not I who can teach you the ways of the gods. The gods are heard only alone, only in silence." And then from this stillness, this willing to listen and turn, then the next stage or part of the journey is a sacred question. Each of us must find our own sacred question. For some, it might be the question of suffering. What to do with the suffering of the world? For some, it might be identity. Who am I? What was I born to be? What is this? You know, at one three-month retreat that we taught here, this Korean Zen master Kusan came, Nine Mountains Monastery. He sat up here at the end of the three-month retreat and looked out and heard about the practice people feeling their breath and naming and acknowledging the different states of body and mind. And he said, "You know, this practice you do, no good." 3 months they'd been sitting there doing. He said, "You won't get enlightened from this, no good." People's hearts sank, you know. And then he said, "There's only one practice." And he banged his stick on the floor. "What is this? What is this?" So that's a sacred question.
Do you remember me relating to this French film that we could never remember the name of? But the story of it is fascinating because it's about a guy who is very much in love with his wife. They have a wonderful relationship, typical sort of, you know, ordinary Parisian living in the suburbs. And he meets another woman on the train, and they become friends and ultimately have an affair. And he discovers, much to his amazement, that he loves his wife as much as ever and also enjoys this other woman. And it strikes him that he's capable of this enormous amount of love, that he can be in love with two people at the same time. And it's so amazing to him that he doesn't want to keep it secret from his wife. So he tells his wife that he loves her dearly and also was attracted to this other woman and has been having an affair with her. But he doesn't want it to be a hidden thing because it strikes him that his nature, that maybe human nature, is the possibility that one can have more than one loves at the same time. And this drives her insane, and she ultimately kills herself.
We're all permitted just a small amount of love in life, and if we attempt to make a withdrawal beyond some of the account's value, we find that our check on life bounces. So this man's mistake was to think that the horizons of love were infinite.
Why do you say that? I mean, why isn't it possible to love more than one person deeply, and what's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with it. You just can't tell everyone about it.
So then his problem was his lack of discretion.
Exactly.
Well, then it isn't really a matter of his having loved so much. It's a matter of his having spoken of
it.
Yeah.
And because he attempted to share it and amplify it through sharing it, he became a poisonous vector.
Do you think that it is necessary to lie in order to get through life, even lie to those who are closest to you? Is that just a given?
I think we all lie all the time, and that if we didn't, the world would function very poorly. That lies are a social lubricant.
But when you lie, you're always betraying yourself, betraying your own truth.
But a lie also is a protective act. And sometimes the lie protects the liar, and sometimes it protects someone related to the liar, and sometimes it protects the person to whom the lie is being told. So that it is, in fact, like a firewall in many instances.
But it's a firewall that creates a sense of alienation and distance, because...
Only if it's discovered.
Well, no, but to the extent that you have to lie to anybody is the extent to which you're not living in truth with that person, and therefore, in some sense, alienated or distanced from that person. And the more untruthful you are, say, to protect yourself or protect them...
What about protecting them? Yes, exactly. Through the concealment of...
truth.
Then, in fact, you're committing a positive act. Here's the question. Would the lie that he was not having an affair have saved the life of his beloved wife?
Oh, surely.
Then would that lie not have been of positive value in the movie? The answer is yes, it would have been very valuable.
Well, then the next question is, perhaps he shouldn't have been engaged in that affair in the first place, so he wouldn't have had to lie. Is it necessary in life, in order to do what you want, to have what you want, to get what you want, to lie?
It depends, really, upon what you want. If you wish to climb a mountain, the chances of your needing to lie about it are relatively smaller compared with if you wish to have an extramarital affair.
Well, it would be bizarre if you told the truth about an extramarital affair and then lied about climbing a mountain.
It's true. In fact, this man, in the movie that Larry related to you,
mm-hmm.
was a mountain climber, but a clandestine mountain climber. He had secretly climbed K2, Everest, and a series of smaller Himalayan peaks, including some Andean mountains.
But he never told his wife
about it. He had prevaricated to the extent that these were represented as business trips or sightseeing surveys.
But wouldn't it be interesting if we were to extrapolate that into our lives, which is to say, if we were to lie about the most unimportant things and tell the truth about the most devastating things?
I interviewed some terrific, now dead, famous costume designers in the 40s and 50s that I was thinking of putting a book together on. You know, one was this really great, famous design for Columbia Pictures. When I interviewed him in the 80s, I drove up to Montecito to interview him, and he came out in a little Airtay kind of a wig, and he was in his 80s, I guess, two little lap dogs in each hand, little Gucci loafers, with little chains on him, He was tiny, and he came in very sweet. And when I came into his house, I had to be very quiet because his wife was apparently dying, and there was a priest there administering last rites.
And he was doing an interview with
you. Yeah, and I said, well, Jesus, are you sure, sir, that you'd like me to be here right now? I mean, I understand that you may feel I was a little put out by driving all the way up to Montecito, but I would certainly come back. He said, oh, no, darling. No, absolutely not. Sit down and we'll have it. He was very gracious, and there was the odd undertone of gloom permeating the house with this pending thing going on in the other room.
So you conducted an interview with him while a priest was administering last rites to his wife, who was dying,
And how did the interview go? I mean, was he upbeat? Cheerful?
Oh, God, yeah. He was terrific, you know, reminiscing in the sweetest way. And
reminiscing about what?
Oh, you know, he was reminiscing about his years at the studio. And, you know, we talked about certain, you know, he designed that Monroe gown that she sang, you know, Happy Birthday to Kennedy in. The famous seven-year itch dress that, you know, with a blast of air underneath her.
From a subway grating.
Yeah. He did all of Marilyn Monroe, and as he got more and more bombed, he told me something that I still don't believe to this day, but he really shocked the hell out of me. He told me that he had been asked to dress Marilyn Monroe after she had passed, you know, at
the mortuary.
The mortuary, yeah. And that by the time he got to her, she had been totally mangled, you know, that both of her breasts had been cut off, a lot of her hair had been cut off, implying that Dr. Noguchi's insane coroner's assistants now have, like, one of, you know, Marilyn's pickled breasts on a mantelpiece, or, you know, or a lock of her hair framed in some old geezers at this point. I mean, I didn't know whether to believe that or not. But it was an interesting story for him to tell me because, you know, he was opening up and he was weeping and it was...
Were those the only parts of her body that were missing or were there other parts that had been removed?
Those were the only parts that he mentioned. That was enough for me, but he got very, very emotional when we discussed Monroe because that's what he's famous for, is designing all of the costumes in her biggest movies in the 50s.
And how long after the interview did the wife, in fact, die?
She didn't die that day, as it turned out, but I believe she died like about a week and a half later. The last really major piece I ever wrote was I interviewed Betty Davis before she died. It was her last interview.
And what was that like?
Oh, that was quite interesting in that, well, I had designed a pair of, you know, when you get old, your nose and your ears grow, right? Her ears at this point were of Dumbo size, so I had decided to design these jeweled mask earrings that basically covered her entire ear.
How did the earrings cover the entire ear? I thought earrings only hang from the earlobe.
I had figured out a way to attach the ear clasp in a way where it would cup over both of her ears entirely. They were huge, huge earrings.
But they sound like ear muffs, not earrings.
They were. They were bejeweled muffs. I mean, she loved them. I was very flattered that she did.
And what did you do for her nose?
That, I'm afraid I couldn't help her out on. But I liked her a lot, and we had a nice long 4-hour chat. You know, she was chain smoking, and she would, gesticulate wildly, and when the middle of one discussion, you know, she had this lit cigarette and it just went flying out of her hand, and she didn't know that it had flown out of her hand, and I certainly couldn't interrupt her in the middle of the, you know, what she was talking about Warner Brothers and say, you know, excuse me, Miss Davis, but your apartment's on fire. And she had an assistant there, a very glamorous woman that was working for her and I believe lived there, who would walk around and pick these lit cigarettes up and dispose of them. caught me in the perfect moment. Here I was walking onto the terrace, and I see Zach flipping a curled up tissue over the side of the terrace, 37 floors above the street.
Mm-hmm.
He just tossed it over there as if it was a big garbage can, just tossing it over the side. So I just lost it because there's so much about his...
You mean the accumulation of all the things like urinating on toilet seats and...
Yeah, it just doesn't stop. It just doesn't stop. I've just got a hair trigger, you know, everything he does is, just gets me crazy.
Yeah, you sounded quite upset.
No, I can't control myself. It's just, I feel like he's just, you know, wasting his life and becoming more and more nasty to me and dismissive. And
how is he wasting his life?
I don't know exactly what he does, but from day to day, but I think it's essentially just trying to figure out where to... Well, they wander around. Him and his friends wander around. They go to St. Mark's Place. They go, I don't know what they do in their wanderings. They go to record stores. I guess that's what everybody does. But basically, they're looking to score grass. And then they just smoke it all up. They don't even budget it. It's all about that. And it just seems wasteful. And his teachers constantly are calling and talking about his... Even as the semester's coming to an end, the last few days, you know, he was rude. He didn't do his work. It's a real struggle. I don't know what to do. I don't know. I'm at my wit's end with Zachary.
What's he doing?
Every minute, every day, there's something else.
What do you mean?
Just actions that are inappropriate. Actions that are like spitting on the floor. He spits on the floor.
In the apartment?
Yeah.
He doesn't even go into the bathroom and spit into a sink or into a
toilet. No, not at all. You got to spit right on the floor. Because that's when he wants to spit, so he spits. He doesn't have time to go to the bathroom. And it's a weird thing. It's strange. It's really strange. I don't know.
Thursday, 5:55 p.m.
Hi, it's Danny again. After the thought, 1 minute later, I forgot to tell you something a little more humorous on the health side. About 2 months ago, Jogu has been sober for a few years. She was a homeless drunk in the marina and worked on her hair, and she had a little shop there. She was married to Buddy, who was my FBI retired friend. They're divorced now, and Nancy divorced. But Clover's sober now, and actually, she and Buddy visited us once in the desert, and they had an argument, and he poured water on her, and she came chasing after him with a knife. But anyway, things have changed. But she's got a new husband now. He's a very wealthy oil man, and they live in Houston. But he's a hopeless drunk. And she says he's really in bad shape because he's got a very swollen testicle, and he knows he's got something seriously wrong with it, probably cancer, and he won't do anything about it. So then I started checking my nuts. Lo and behold, I have a swollen right nut, you know. But not the nut itself, but the lot of crap around it. And I immediately think I've got nut cancer. So I had an appointment 2 days ago, and my regular physician took me into a dark room and put a flashlight in my scrotum. I didn't see what he was doing. He said, well, it doesn't look bad, but we better check it with urologist. The urologist, I told him the story. The urologist took me in the same room, flashed this light in my right nut. He said, this is gorgeous, deep red color. And I said, shit, I belong on a Christmas tree. He probably heard that before, but in any event, that turned out okay. I'm all right, but it scared the shit out of me for a while. But one day I can be a in a store. I can be a Christmas tree ornament at night. I'll just strip down and take a flashlight in my nuts. I thought she might enjoy that. Talk to you later. Bye.
I love my father. I really do. He's a riot. He's you know, when it comes to being a responsible dad, you know, he didn't really grow up.
I like to read this poem on retreats that someone gave me because it's such a reminder of where we come from. It's called Reverse Living. Life is tough. And what do you get at the end of it? Death, a great reward. I think that the life cycle's all backwards. You should die first, get it out of the way. Then you live 20 years in an old age home. You get kicked out when you're too young. You get a gold watch, you go to work. You work 40 years until you're young enough to enjoy your retirement. You go to college. You party until you're ready for high school. You become a little kid. You play. You have no responsibilities. You become a little boy or girl. You go back into the womb. You spend your last 9 months floating. And you finish off as a gleam in someone's eye. There's something about coming to the bottom of this, coming to that essence of spiritual life, to that original, timeless wholeness, to that innocence that we were born with. And then we return and enter the world again, but somehow changed. There's the story of Ramakrishna, one of the great sages in India and saints, who prayed and practiced and devoted himself to spiritual life. And what he wanted more than anything was to have a vision of the divine, of the holy. And for him, the divine was particularly the great mother, Ma, the great divine feminine. And one day, as Ramakrishna tells the story, he was sitting by the banks of the Ganges River in meditation and in this great kind of beseeching, may I open to that which is divine. And all of a sudden, a vision appeared. He opened his eyes, and out of the river came this incredible being, this beautiful woman, the goddess that creates all things. And she looked at him with eyes sparkling and hair dripping the water of the river. This huge form, and then she opened her body to him, and out of her body, from between her legs, poured the birth of all life. Children and beings and plants and animals of all kinds, she was giving birth to the world. He was absolutely astonished, in awe and delighted. And then she looked him in the eye and reached down and picked up a handful of babies and put them in her mouth and began to chew on them, and the blood ran down her lips and across her breasts, and she looked him in the eye, and then sank back down beneath the waves in the river Ganges. That was his vision. If you sit, you will encounter it all. Beauty, evil, joy and sorrow, praise and blame, it's all there. And it's a great task to sit and open ourselves as a Buddha to what this human life gives us. And in bringing awareness to it, to all of life, there comes a profound healing. The healing arises when we do not put anything out of our heart. When we sit, we see it in ourselves, our loneliness and grief, our fear, all the things that we've run from. The forces in us, as in the world, that create suffering, greed, hatred, delusion, prejudice. The pains in the body, the struggles in the heart. And what we're asked is to find a new way to touch and to hold all of that. You know, in Tibetan Buddhist practice, one prays for difficulties and sufferings. May I be granted appropriate hardships so that the true heart of compassion can awaken in me. True prayer and love, says Thomas Merton, are learned in the hour when prayer becomes impossible and the heart has turned to stone. And in the real difficulties, we start to see that we don't control or own or possess anything. We see all the storms inwardly and outwardly and seek that place of freedom in the heart that can bow to it all and awaken in its midst. As Suzuki Roshi said when he was dying of cancer, "If when I die, if I suffer, that's all right, you know. That's just suffering, Buddha. No confusion in it. Maybe everyone will suffer because of the physical pain or agony or the spiritual agony. That's just suffering, Buddha. Sun Buddha, moon Buddha, happy Buddha, sad Buddha. To bow to it all and rest in the midst. A peace, as Thomas Merton said, not of emotional resignation, but of the openness of heart that has seen everything without refutation or argument."
Standing on your porch, you saw Jesus dragging the cross, a crowd around him, cursing him, mocking him, spitting
right.
on him.
No, but it wasn't in my neighborhood. No, I saw it. Like I was in Judea when it happened. I didn't see him walking down my street. I saw him walking down the street.
So you were transported back in time.
That's what I was seeing. Yes.
And you saw that on a number of nights, right?
Two or three nights.
Yeah. And what did
and
you
then
make
I saw Christ on the back of a truck.
What was he doing?
Holding the cross. It was really f***ed up.
And when you would have these visions, what would you think?
I thought I was going crazy. To be honest, Joe, I've always thought that my performance at work, in some kind of way, has been like an acting job and not real. It's never been real to me. It's not real to me like I know it's real to people that I work with. For them, I know that that's their life. For me, it's a place that I go to act a role every day. It's not who I am. It has nothing to do with anything that I want. It has nothing to do with anything that I ever really think about. It's like being paid to perform on a soap opera every day. And I know that there. I work with people all the time who don't believe that. I mean, to them, they go to work, it's their job and their focus, and for me, it's just like, it might as well be a set.
And you're improvising. Nobody's giving you lines. You have to make them up.
Sometimes I get very, very scared that someone's going to discover it. I couldn't be less interested in what I'm doing.
What would you be interested in doing?
even now, and I haven't played for damn near 20 years now, I mean, I would love to go back to playing drums again with people and create music, beautiful music. I even think of, you know, I'd like to be able to work on writing music. I mean, I would love to be able to do those things. That's all I ever wanted to do, Joe. I never wanted to do what I'm doing now. This wasn't what my life was supposed to be like. It's horrible. I mean, my life wasn't supposed to be about this, for God's sakes. I spent my whole life wanting to be a musician and an artist, believing in that, in the sanctity of that. And slowly but surely, had to
make practical decisions
that pushed me further and further away from it. But what I never changed was my temperament. What I never changed was who I really was, which has nothing to do with the things that I've continued to have to do.
So who you are is in no relation to the work that you do.
The people that I work with have no f***ing idea who I am. They don't have a clue who I am. I mean, having a conversation like this with one of those people, or even being close to them on a level that would allow you to have a conversation like this, is something that is beyond possibility. I mean, totally beyond possibility. And at the time that I was having those experiences, I think I was just way, way over my head. You know, I bought a house that was more money than I could afford. I was already in debt. My daughter's school was costing, you know, what it cost me to go to college. I was overworked. I was working, you know, huge hours. When I wasn't working, all I was doing was coming home, taking care of my daughter, losing my temper with her, very upset that I was losing my temper with her. So I was always, you know, beating myself up about not treating her well. I mean, it was just a tough time. I think if you can't see Christ during the tough times, when are you going to see Christ? I think that's what it was. I must admit, though, to you that I really thought that it was real at the time.
But I'm going through a very strange experience of not believing that I could ever really be physically intimate with a woman. It's been some time, you know, and it's something happening where the whole idea of physical intimacy repulses me a bit. And this is very unlike me. I still see beautiful women and I go, you know, and oh God, you know, I'm really, you know, turned on. No, like I'm not. But when I think about what it's like to be physically intimate, to sleep with someone, to sleep in someone's arms, I can't imagine it. It's like the act of sex is becoming clinical and it's losing its exotic, luxuriant, mystical qualities, which is very distressing. And I hope it's not really true that there will come a time when I can experience that kind of intimacy. But it's hard for me to imagine.
I have seen Christ in the service bay of my local Lee Miles, replacing the muffler on the Chevy 4x4s. I have seen Christ at a spinning class at the Crunch Workout Gym on 83rd Street and Amsterdam Avenue. He was wearing a pair of spandex shorts, Nike cross trainers, and a tank top. I've seen Jesus Christ in a folded paper hat made from a number 6 brown paper bag, tossing uncooked bagels into a vat of boiling water at the H&H Bagel Factory on Broadway and 80th Street. I have seen Jesus Christ holding on to a strap on the D train
as it hurtled into oblivion uptown after 59th Street. He was carrying a saxophone case. I have seen Christ with a trowel in his hand applying cement to a brick-and-mortar wall rising around a prison being built in Onondaga, New York, an audience of small children watching him. I saw Christ in a sawmill feeding planks into a threshing machine. Then he got up, excused himself politely, closed the door to the men's, and one could hear him in a kind of profound gastric experience, because God possesses both a gastrointestinal tract and the ability to take away our transgressions through his limitless sacrifice. I see Christ everywhere. I see him in the sneakers thrown over the top of the clothesline. I see him in the broken fingernail of a would-be diva standing outside a closed video store, bad and drunk on a Saturday night, her body gone to shit and her mind a great open field through which March memory is best forgotten. I see Christ in the syringe on a control knob in an empty exercise hall. I see him on the third rail. I see him behind safety glass. I see him ministering to an amputee in a field hospital. I see him building inexpensive high-fidelity speakers. I see him trudging shoeless towards the 72nd Street subway station on a snowy night.
What I'm doing right now is I'm lying on this soft couch out on my balcony. It's on the 37th floor. The light is sinking in the southwest, making the clouds glow, these low clouds that don't appear to be moving. And from where I'm lying, there's only sky behind me and to the side. The only thing that is interrupting this beautiful sky is a huge crane that is perched about 40 stories above the ground. A new building is just being finished, colossally ugly. The motif is a kind of chocolate and tan bricks for 40 plus stories. I can't imagine how they decided to make this chocolate and tan building, which is of course obliterating the view of the old Garment District, which is a gorgeous part of New York, the old Garment District. But this crane is still up there. You know, it's the kind of crane that they move up each time they move to another floor. And of course, the workmen have just topped off the building and put a huge American flag, which I could see if I stick up a bit. Oh, they put the flag down, but for a few days, once they reach the top, the construction workers put a huge American flag up there.
You mean the American flag was like reaching the top of Mount Everest? You plant a flag when you reach the top?
I think that's in their own twisted way, the way the construction workers viewed the reaching the top of the building.
They plant a flag.
Like conquering Everest, they had built the building.
So they built Everest.
They built it and conquered it. Or they decided that when you build something, you conquer. I guess they feel they conquered the space that was there before the building was there. You used to be able to look through that space and see the golden dome of the Metropolitan Life Insurance Building down around 23rd Street, and that's gone. On the other hand, of course, this building, I think, will perhaps be an apartment building, and that means there's a good chance there'll be some naked women walking around apartments soon.
So have you purchased a telescope?
I haven't gotten a telescope yet, but that would not be a bad Hanukkah present if you were thinking of sending me something. So maybe it won't be a total loss, the loss of the sky. It's a beautiful sky, and the light is coming from the southwest, and the sky is still
kind of a darkish blue, and it's still pretty bright. The way the clouds kind of glow, they look so soft, like you could just sit on it, lie down on it, and, you know, roll around. It's so magnificent. It's just amazingly beautiful. I've just never seen anything. It seems more beautiful tonight than I've ever seen it before, even though I'm sure I've said that before. There's just something mystical and magical about looking at the sky, and I think, wow, I mean, how could this have been created? How could this be here? What could have caused this sky to come into being? What could have caused this light, this magnificent, beautiful, joyous, you know, and I'm
what is that? Hold it.
Hello?
Yeah.
I changed the channel.
Okay.
I don't know. It's electrical bullshit. I mean, it just brings such joy to my spirit just to see this light in the sky. Nothing else has to happen. And I've been out here other times with other friends, and I remember someone telling me that they were convinced that this sky could only have been created by a god. And I considered that, and I consider it even now as I look at this beautiful thing.
It's starting again.
No, I can't control that shit, man.
Well, then just...
What am I supposed to do?
Well, when you hear it, stop, and then continue. When it stops, it stopped again.
There's obviously some bullshit going on.
Right, yeah.
This building thing. Maybe it's that crane, electrical crane, putting out rays. So I remember sitting out here a few times and looking at the sky and sharing it with people, and I remember one time someone suggested to me that this was surely the work of God, that it's the only way you could explain this magnificence. Was that God had created it. But of course you can't, you know, have it one way. If God's responsible for all this beauty, then he sure as hell is responsible for the rest.
Enveloping you in some great amniotic swirl.